Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. GM workers in Europe are getting laid off just like those here in the U.S., but the consequences aren't quite as dire.
One day you have a job and the other day you're in poverty, and we don't have those things here.
We'll hear about the safety net in Belgium. And sure, parents want to chip in if a child loses a job, but tapping into the retirement fund?
You can't do that. Who's going to help you when you're in your 60s or 70s or 80s, and it's going to fall back on your kid anyway?
And loan counselors are like guardian angels for those in foreclosure.
I work probably like maybe 3 hours of overtime a day and maybe one Saturday a month. But that's okay, because that's what we're here for right now.
We'll peel off the layers of the government's Making Home Affordable program. And after that, we'll talk with office workers in England who recently peeled off all their layers. We're hiding behind the water cooler on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. We've talked a lot on this program about how the credit card industry is cracking down on consumers, jacking up interest rates on existing balances, lowering credit limits. But at least one bank went even further and shut down credit lines for hundreds of thousands of small businesses. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com.
It's been less than 2 months since Congress passed all those new rules, making it tougher for credit card issuers to change the rules on their customers. But the law doesn't take effect until February, and in the meantime, banks are doing everything they can to make a buck before it gets harder to do so. This week, Senator Chris Dodd warned credit card companies about hiking interest rates in anticipation of the new rules. But one bank took steps that surprised even the FDIC, and now the agency is basically shutting it down. Marketplace's Steve Henn has the story.
Just 2 months ago, Advanta Bank was one of the largest suppliers of small business credit cards in America. But on June 10th, the bank cut off credit to all of its 1 million customers. And overnight, shop owners across the country lost their short-term credit.
My name is Gillette Kempf, and I own Borealis Bookstore. It's a small, independent bookstore in Wadena, Minnesota.
Kempf was one of Advanta Bank's customers. And losing her credit card wasn't the only surprise with her online account. Advanta also raised the interest rate on her balance from 7% to 34%.
I got to the bottom of that electronic statement and looked at that, and I just felt ill. I felt like I'd been betrayed.
The FDIC was flooded with complaints, and last week it forced Advanta Bank to pay back $35 million to customers like Kempf.
They basically accused them of cheating their own customers out of $35 million.
Richard Newsom is a fraud investigator and former bank examiner. He says the default rates on Advanta's credit cards skyrocketed recently, hitting 20%, and the bank's finances are precarious. Apparently, federal regulators agree. Last week, they ordered Advanta Bank to create a plan to stop accepting new deposits, pay its existing depositors back, and then terminate its FDIC insurance.
The bank is essentially being forced out of business by the FDIC.
But Newsom says the FDIC can't legally shut down the bank's parent company. And that parent company, Advanta Corp., is still trying to attract new investors, aggressively advertising short-term investment notes that offer rates as high as 11%.
But these are securities that are actually advertised in the San Francisco Chronicle. The target of these securities is like moms and pops. They're designed to be sold to unsophisticated people.
Newsom studied the company's public filings, and he believes that because Advanta Bank is being pushed out of business, soon the only money Advanta Corp. will have to pay off old investors will have to come from new investors.
Practically speaking, it's like has aspects of a Ponzi scheme.
Several former securities officials and banking law experts agree. But Art Wilmarth, a law professor at George Washington University, says it isn't clear if anyone has the legal authority to shut Advanta Corp. down.
This is an industrial loan company, which is essentially a loophole institution.
Wilmarth says these industrial loan companies are not directly regulated by anyone. The Obama administration would like to shut all of these firms down, but until Congress changes the law, it can't. So in the meantime, Richard Newsom has this advice for anyone thinking of investing in Advanta Corp.
Run for the exits.
Advanta executives did not respond to repeated requests for comment. I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
Bankruptcy mechanics came out from under the hood of General Motors on Friday. The company engineered a remarkably quick exit from Chapter 11 after reaching a deal to sell off a chunk of its assets. One of those assets is GM's European division, Opel. About 10,000 jobs will probably disappear once the sale is finalized, just like what's happened on this side of the pond. Reporter Brett Neely went to Antwerp, Belgium to find out what happens next for GM workers across the Atlantic.
The story of Belgian auto worker Bjorn Wouters will probably sound familiar to many of his American counterparts. He was 22 when he started working in the paint shop of the local GM factory. That was nearly 10 years ago. Bjorn went to work for GM because his father worked there. Seemed like a good job.
Because I thought, yeah, well, this will be the employer to my retirement. And straight off, they started restructuring and everything.
Just like many car factories in the Midwest, the Antwerp factory's best days are past. 20 years ago, there were 13,000 GM workers here. Today, Bjorn is one of just 2,600 who are left. The plant may not survive the next round of cuts.
There's definitely something coming, but, well, we are not worrying. Well, we are worrying, of course, but we're not speculating.
Though workers on both sides of the Atlantic share a sense of uncertainty, there are big differences in their situations. In Belgium, like most European countries, there's universal health care. Pensions are paid by the government, even if that comes at a cost. Taxes are high here, around 50% of earnings. But former GM workers in Antwerp aren't worried about their pensions and health care benefits disappearing, as they might be in the U.S. At an employment office in central Antwerp, a dozen former GM workers are having a monthly meeting. They're supposed to talk about looking for jobs. Mostly, they're shooting the breeze. I asked them how the job hunt is going.
That's a delicate subject.
They're not really looking for work. Because they're all over 50 and have 30 years of service, these workers got a special early retirement deal. They get long-term unemployment from the government, about $1,500 a month after taxes. Plus, they get what's called a bypass. Basically, GM kicks in about $700 or so a month. In the end, they receive about 70 or 80% of what they made while on the assembly line, for doing nothing. It's a pretty good deal, says retiree Maurice van de Moerbeukel.
But I am very busy. I got a lot of hobbies, we called it. I'm going to fish, I'm going to ride bike. I do a lot of things.
The dark cloud on the horizon is that the factory here could close. Then these retirees would lose their bypass payments, the $700. Still, they'd keep their unemployment benefits. Brigitte Blom is an employment counselor who's helping the early retirees. She says GM's early retirement plan is, in some ways, a set of golden handcuffs for the workers.
Because they have too much money for doing nothing, so they see if I'm going to work, the difference, it's maybe 200 euros, then I'm working for 200 euros.
She says despite the recession, there are still plenty of jobs in Antwerp, even for 50-something factory workers. Belgium's unemployment rate is just 8.2%, below the U.S. rate of 9.5%, and below the average in Europe these days. The fact that there are other jobs out there removes stress from workers of all ages. I asked Bjorn Wouters whether he's worried about losing his job at the GM plant.
Worried. No, I'm not actually worried. And if it closes down, which I actually don't imagine, but if it closes down, well, then I'll go look for another job.
Even if he can't find one, Bjorn will get pretty generous unemployment benefits. About 60% of his income for the first year, though it drops a little after that. Bjorn says Belgian workers are lucky to have this level of social protection. And he sympathizes when he reads about his counterparts in America, who are having a tougher time.
One day you have a job, and the other day you're in poverty, and also entire cities that get depopulated because a factory closes, and we don't have those things here.
But like his American colleagues, Bjorn Wouter's fate isn't in his hands. Any day now, GM will sign a deal to sell its European operations to a new owner, who may decide to close the Antwerp factory. In Antwerp, Belgium, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We all know saving money is not easy, at least not for most of us. So it's really quite amazing that the savings rate has jumped so much in the past year, an excellent side effect of the financial crisis. But we're still far from where most experts would like us to be. And a recent study shows that saving is much harder for some folks than it is for others. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, offers his thoughts in this week's Straight Story.
The study, authored by the Ariel Foundation and Hewitt Associates, is called 401k Plans in Living Color. The results of digging deep into retirement savings plans of some 3 million employees at nearly 60 of the nation's largest companies are sobering. African Americans and Hispanics aren't saving as much as their white peers. They're less likely to participate in company retirement plans. They take out more loans from the plan. These results hold even after taking into account salary, education, age, and other factors. The retirement savings gap is wide. The paper offers a number of recommendations to address the problem. Among the ideas put forward are improving financial literacy and better communication with workers. Who can disagree with that? And companies like McDonald's and IBM are doing good work in this regard. For example, McDonald's doesn't rely on pamphlets and computer messages to convince employees that saving for retirement is important. It puts human resources folks out in the field to talk to workers about the topic in the 401k plan. Still, it's not all bad news in the report. First, I was surprised how well minorities were doing with retirement savings. The African American and Hispanic communities have very little wealth compared to whites. The gap in net worth is a deep canyon with many causes. But it would be a mistake to conclude that minorities aren't saving. They are, but with different priorities. Hewitt's research shows that African Americans have put home ownership and a college education ahead of retirement when it comes to savings and investing. I can't criticize that. My other reaction? The low level of retirement savings among minorities is the proverbial canary in the coal mine. The current retirement savings system is unstable. Witness the two major stock market meltdowns in 8 years. What the study says to me is that the 401k system is letting down most people. It's hardly surprising that minorities would be the most vulnerable. Companies should do more to encourage more savings and participation in these plans, especially by minorities. But the 401k retirement system relies too much on individual choice and market savvy. It doesn't provide a predictable income for old age. The study is just one more reason why reform is imperative.
When seniors can't live on their own, they might move into a retirement home with round-the-clock care. But for some, the housing market has stalled those plans.
Some people I know have not been able to move because they haven't sold their house.
We look at how the downturn has hit retirees next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
We'll be right back.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. One lesson we can all take away from the events of the past year is that there are no guarantees. Your home value will not always go up. Neither will the stock market. But at least if you're, say, younger than 60, you've got some time to make up for losses on both those fronts. If you are nearing or in retirement, you don't have that time. And that's forcing a lot of change on folks who thought they had done all the planning they needed to do. Ashley Milne-Tite has our story.
Hi, Pam. How are you?
Good.
Good. Hi, Ginny. I see you with curlers in your hair.
Marketing director Hilda Sager is giving me a tour of the campus at Masonicare. It's a non-profit company in Connecticut that runs retirement housing for seniors. She chats to residents and staff as she shows off the dining hall, the pool hall, even the beauty parlor.
I can see you, but you can't see me. You look good.
This part of the campus, Ashla Village, is the fancy bit. You pay a so-called entrance fee of at least $100,000 to get a cottage or apartment here, plus monthly rent. Sega shows me around one of their new apartments.
Master bath with a walk-in shower with the seat notice grab bars for safety.
It's almost 1,500 square feet with lots of sunlight, two bedrooms and walk-in closets. Masonicare CEO Steve McPherson says a few years ago,
these would have been sold and we would have had a wait list for them.
As it is, 15 of the 70 new apartments are still available. Masonicare isn't the only senior living facility in this position. Occupancy rates at residences around the country are down by several percent on average. The lousy housing market is trapping older people in their current homes.
I'm Nancy Pfeiffer.
Nancy is 87. To raise the $300,000 entrance fee for their apartment here, she and her husband Dag put the house of 44 years on the market in February of last year. Dag says 6 months later, they were getting desperate.
And we bought the little statue of St. Joseph. And we
off the internet.
Put him in the ground upside down, and he didn't like it. And I said, you help us sell, and I get you out of here.
I can't believe this. 10 days after we bought the statue and planted him, we got these two offers.
They got a lot less than they wanted, but it was enough to let them move into Masonicare. Nancy says at times they worried about the future.
We were debating whether we would move, and some people I know have not been able to move because they haven't sold their house.
The prospect of having their intake eroded by a faltering economy has prompted Masonicare and other companies to offer assistance to prospective residents. Some are helping to stage homes for sale. Others are offering discounts on their entrance fees. But it's not only prospective residents who are struggling. The sharp drop in the stock market is hurting some people inside the walls. The value of their retirement portfolios has taken a hammering, and that's affecting their quality of life. Masonicare resident Anne Beeler is 73. Her husband died last year. When he got sick, she sold off a chunk of her IRA to help finance his medical bills. Later, she was hit with a hefty tax bill for that sale. Then the markets plummeted.
And since then, my IRA has gone down to $24,000. And right now, my income is less than my outgoing. So I'm forced to move into a studio apartment now.
Anne says she never anticipated hitting financial trouble at this age. But even in a healthy economy, it's not unheard of for seniors to outlive their resources. Richard Grimes is CEO of the Assisted Living Federation of America. With assisted living, seniors who are too frail to live at home rent an apartment for around $3,000 a month and can get help with daily tasks like bathing or dressing. They don't pay an entrance fee. Grimes says each year about 6% of residents in those communities end up having to move out because they're running low on funds.
What the community does first is to try to help them get their financial house in order so that they can stay, ideally. And if they can't stay, then they try to help them find another community that they can afford.
But communities aren't always that helpful. New Jersey's public advocate has criticized an assisted living company there for serving residents in their 80s and 90s with eviction notices when their money was about to run out. In at least one case, those dwindling funds were related to last year's stock market drop. But Grimes says the downturn is bringing one unexpected benefit.
The silver lining in what's happening in the economy is that it's easier to keep staff. It's easier to find good qualified staff. Nurses are coming back to work in assisted living.
Senior living companies hope that situation will continue because they know they'll need more staff in the coming years. Right now, about 20% of people 75 and older live in some kind of senior housing. But the number of people in that age group is rising every year. I'm Ashley Milne-Tight for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
It's time for Getting Personal when we take on your questions. And here with me once again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. And Chris, we've got Carol on the phone from your neck of the woods, Jordan, Minnesota. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
So how can we help you out today?
Well, I'm a first-time homeowner, and I'm looking at closing on August 10th. That part of my deal is all set, but I have yet to settle on a lock.
Oh, a lock on the interest rate.
Yes.
Okay.
And they've gone up, they go down, and my lender tells me, let's wait it out. But today, it's 5.25 right now.
So what are you waiting for?
Well, that's what I want to know. I mean, she keeps telling me it's going to go lower. 5% sounds better than 5.25. And, you know, when I first started this process of buying the house in March, they were 4 point something. So
right.
My question to you is, yeah, is it Ouija board? Is it a, you know, the psychic hotline? Is there something that tells you when to do it?
What do you think, Chris? I'm going for Ouija board.
I'm going for dartboard.
Okay.
Okay. You know, we play different games. But who knows where rates will be by August 10th? I mean, I think it's a fairly safe bet that you miss bottom. And the way that I think about a lock, it's just looking at what's the risk if rates go up versus what's the gain if rates go down. Maybe they get up to 5.8, 5.7. And with a lock, you protect yourself from that. My feeling is, why not have a little bit of certainty? I would say, go lock.
Okay.
Now, before you fully, you know, pay attention to me, there is also, for more information, if you go to the website hsh.com, they have a consumer's guide to mortgage lock-ins, lays out what a lock-in is, what the terms are, how to think about it. So for people who want more information, that's where I would go.
Safer than a Ouija board.
Yeah, it's definitely better than a Ouija board. And Carol, you've found your home already, right?
Oh, it's beautiful.
So don't you want to get in it?
I do. I'm going in August 10th, no matter what happens. So, in fact, I'm a driver's ed teacher for the Jordan School District, and I'm taking my drivers over there, and I make it part of my lesson. Here's my new house.
All right. So did we answer your question?
I think you did. I need to lock down, I think. I'm going to follow your advice.
Lock it in and enjoy your new home.
I will. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, let's take another mortgage question. Maya is in Breckenridge, Colorado. Beautiful Breckenridge. Hi, Maya.
Hi, it is beautiful.
Yeah, are you a skier?
I am, yes. Not right now. We still have a little snow, but not too much.
All right, well, in the meantime, off the slopes, how can we help you today?
Well, my husband and I went under contract in April on a house which is currently under construction, and we expect to close sometime around September, and housing prices are still up here in Breckenridge. Median home prices are nearly $1 million, and we only recently decided we could afford to buy because interest rates were so low. But we couldn't lock in an interest rate until 90 days prior to closing, which is about where we are right now. And in the last few weeks, interest rates have gone way up to almost over 6%, and we're not sure we can afford payments at that rate. And so we wanted to know if we should walk away from the house and we would lose the $10,000 that we put down as earnest money, or if we should expect the interest rates are going to go down before September.
Well, Chris, this is a very familiar question that we just had with Carol as well. People wondering if there's any way to predict the movement of interest rates.
There is no way to predict it, but it seems to me you're really stretching your finances to buy. I mean, that's what I take away from it.
We are.
In light of all the experience that we've had over the past 2-3 years, people have stretched their finances. It worked out for a period of time. It usually did. And what, Tess, usually a year or two it worked out.
Right.
But then something happens. You know, it can be a lost job, a medical illness, a pay cut, a furlough, and all of a sudden, finances are really stretched. And then you've got this big monster mortgage that you got to deal with. There's a strong desire to own a home. Breckenridge is an expensive area. Prices have just gotten down to a point where you can step into that home ownership. But are you stretching your finances too much? I mean, where's your margin of safety?
So, Chris, really, you're just saying that if a 1% difference in the interest rate means that you can't afford the mortgage, you shouldn't be getting this place.
That's my reaction, because owning a home is expensive. They're expensive to maintain. They're expensive to run. There's always hidden costs.
And we were thinking of all those costs, and that's why we were had sort of made this our goal, was about that 5%. And 6% we could do, but that would be where we would be teetering.
So Chris, you know, Maya and her husband would then lose this $10,000 down payment. But I think what you're saying here is they could lose a lot more if they get into a house that they really are stretching to afford.
Yeah. So that's what I'd be doing, Maya. Just looking at the loss of the $10,000, that would really hurt. But, you know, looking at the loss of that versus the risk that you're taking and, you know, come up with what's the most sensible strategy for you. And so you don't end up in financial trouble. If it turns out owning a home, it's going to work, fine. But if it turns out you're really stretching your finances and you're at big risk, I'd be really nervous.
Okay. Well, thanks for your help.
All right. Thanks for the call, Maya. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Well, if you've got a money question in need of an answer, do give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. You can also write to us through our website. It's marketplace.org. Just look for the Getting Personal link there. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It really is nice to know, isn't it, that even 51-year-old U.S. senators sometimes need a little financial helping hand from the rents. This week, Republican Senator John Ensign acknowledged that the Bank of Mom and Dad gifted almost $100,000 to the family of his former mistress last year. On the bright side, he has not asked to move back in with them yet. But in this economy, more and more parents and their adult children are facing that situation. I asked personal finance writer Beth Kobliner how a person knows it's time to boomerang back home.
I think you know.
You just know, huh?
You just know. I think so many people were hoping either to make it on their own or they're just out of school and they can't make it. And if they're lucky enough to have a situation where they feel like it's tenable and they really can move back home with their parents, they have to, of course, talk to their parents about it. And it's often a big shocker for the parents.
Right.
And they say, you're moving back home?
How can parents tell when their kids really do need to move home and maybe when they're just kind of thinking that might be easier for them?
For the most part, parents feel that they really want to help their kids. And I think, well, that's a good, certainly a parental instinct. I'm a parent myself. You know, I know what that feels like. They sometimes do a disservice to their grown children.
Right.
You know, one example was I was just recently in Boston and I was sort of doing this thing where I was giving out personal finance advice on the street. And this woman came over to me and she was so lovely. And she said, you know, my son is 29 and he had a job. It didn't work out. Then he wanted to go to grad school. So I just let him move back home. And he's home now, actually. And he's not working. And, you know, I'm paying his credit card bills. I'm like, what? He's 29. He's able-bodied. And we actually ended up calling him on his cell phone and just said, you know, you got to get out of bed and, you know, get a job.
Certainly, if a child is going to move back into the home, it's going to affect the finances of mom and dad as well. How do you know kind of where the line is on making sure that mom and dad aren't sacrificing their own financial stability?
I think, you know, that cliche of putting your oxygen mask on first before putting it on your child, I think is really particularly poignant during these tough economic times. The number one thing a parent has to think about is if they're having their child move back home, they, the parent, will continue to do basics like contribute to their 401k, contribute to an IRA, continue to save. Because, I mean, I've met people who said, well, we had to stop the 401k payments because I had to help my son, who's 32. You know, you can't do that. who's going to help you when you're in your 60s or 70s or, you know, 80s? And it's going to fall back on your kid anyway, for the most part.
Right. And how do you decide things like whether to charge your kid rent, whether to help them pay off their debts, you know, who pays electric and the other bills and that sort of thing?
Well, I think the first thing is to, you know, it depends upon the situation, of course. If it's somebody who just graduated from college, you know, hitting them with a rental bill at the end of the month would be a bit harsh.
Yeah.
So maybe giving them some sort of grace period, or talk about 6 months or a year, whatever you think is reasonable. We're going to start charging you some sort of rent.
Is that as a lesson?
I think we value things when we pay for them more. And I've had some parents tell me that they've charged their kids a nominal amount of rent, and then they were secretly taking that money and saving it. So when the kid was ready to move out, they said, okay, here, you can use this as a security deposit.
You do hear about situations, particularly in this economy, where people are moving back in with their parents, and perhaps they even have children.
Right. I think it makes it much harder when we're talking about grandchildren moving back home. And I would say that's one clear-cut case. If you have a grown child who has children and they are about to be foreclosed on their home and they're getting into trouble, and you are able as a parent to help them financially, I feel like that is a time to step in and help them so they don't lose their home or lose a car that they use to get to work in order to support the child. So I think there are times when, if they can afford it, it makes sense to rush in and to help them.
And if they can't?
And if they can't, if they feel that it's a viable situation, that they have their child and their grandchild move back with them. But again, the same rules apply when it comes toward, you know, either contributing some amount of rent or paying groceries. You know, I need somebody to stay home because we have to make sure the cable guy is coming, or whatever it is, you know, just
right.
Really making sure it's a team effort, because I think it's really, you know, infantilizing if you don't do that, you know, helping the parent get back up on his feet, because that's the goal. The goal isn't like, okay, now we're all going to live here for the next 20 years. The goal is, how do we help that grown up person, the person in their 20s or 30s or 40s, how do we help them get back on their feet?
Well, Beth Kobliner, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
And speaking of supporting your grown kids,
we're putting the house on the market.
Where are we moving?
Is the house haunted?
Nancy and I are retiring and sailing around the world on my boat. We are living the dream.
What about us?
We thought that you should take responsibility for your own lives.
And this is the exciting part. We're going to put enough money in your accounts for a security deposit on an apartment.
What's this all about?
More than just money. Wait. We're going to get you another kind of support as well.
You're both going to see therapists. Nancy thinks it'll help. And guys, that's non-negotiable.
Hold on. We're not going on the boat. Derek's selling the house. We have to go to therapy? What the f*** happened?
Hey! Look, I know this seems really, really sudden and just sort of unfair and cruel.
But it's non-negotiable.
But it's non-negotiable.
And that moment brought to you by the Adam McKay comedy Step Brothers. Banks are getting government money to help homeowners in foreclosure, but loan counselors say it is rare to find a willing voice on the other end of the line.
And you'll hang up and you'll call and get somebody else. You'll hang up and then maybe you'll get somebody that actually knows what they're talking about.
We'll find out if the Making Home Affordable program is living up to its name. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We'll be right back. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. The number of homeowners facing foreclosure rose again in June, and that is prompting lots of questions about the government's Making Home Affordable program. The Obama administration launched it back in March and told banks to try to lower mortgage interest rates so people could keep up with their payments. Tamara Keith reports that so far the results have been mixed at best.
Michelle McKeever's days are filled with a whole lot of this.
All of our representatives are still assisting other customers. Please hold and your call will be answered momentarily.
McKeever is a housing counselor at Neighborhood Housing Services of Baltimore. The agency's services are free to just about anyone who needs help with their mortgage. McKeever's job? To help people keep their homes. And that means working the phones.
Oh, great. We just want to follow up with you. We know this account right now is in foreclosure. And we want to know, first of all, is there a sale date?
All day, she talks with banks and loan servicing companies, trying to renegotiate the terms of her clients' mortgages. And in theory, it should be easier these days. The idea of the Making Home Affordable program was to simplify the process. It gives lenders and loan servicers financial incentives to cut payments, and it trims mortgage payments down to an amount borrowers can actually afford, no more than 31% of their monthly income. But McKeever says still it can be a confusing and frustrating process.
Sometimes you'll get someone that doesn't know what they're talking about, and you'll hang up and you'll call and get somebody else. You'll hang up and then maybe you'll get somebody that actually knows what they're talking about.
McKeever says it can take months for servicers to consider a loan modification request. She says the banks and servicers she calls just seem overwhelmed.
Thank you for calling the Home Retention Division. My name is Matthew. Can I ask who I'm speaking with today?
In Simi Valley, California, hundreds of people in cubicles are answering the phones at this Bank of America call center. They've been fielding nonstop requests for loan modifications.
For the May's installment, you made that payment. You're also able to make the payment for June within the grace period, and your account is current. Is there some type of hardship that I'm not seeing?
One of the goals of the Making Home Affordable program is to catch people before they fall behind on their payments. But borrowers have to prove they're actually in trouble. They need to provide tax documents and pay stubs, and they can't have too much in savings.
Hi, it's Tammy, Bank of America. How are you?
Tammy Tipton is one of some 7,500 people in the bank's home retention division. She's a loan workout specialist. That means she has the ability to modify someone's mortgage.
Tell it to me straight. Tell me what your situation is, and I will represent you as best as I can.
But it's not all up to her. Homeowners may send their checks to a company like Bank of America, but their loan has most likely been bundled up into securities and sold to investors. Tipton uses a computer program called HomeSaver to figure out whether those investors will be better off with a foreclosure or a loan modification. In most cases, Tipton says a loan modification is best.
The investors are seeing more and more willingness within themselves to say, we need to work with these people. We need to not say no. We need to work with these people. Assisting is better than not getting anything at all. Assisting is better than having more homes that are empty.
The next step is bringing the payments down so the homeowner can afford them. With the blessing of the investors, Tipton can cut interest rates to as low as 2% or take a 30-year mortgage and extend it out to 40 years. Seems simple enough. So why are borrowers and housing counselors complaining about long waits on hold and longer waits for answers? There are just too many people in trouble. Bank of America has doubled its staff in the Home Retention Division in the last 8 months. But it has more than 1.5 million customers behind on their payments. Tipton says it's overwhelming.
I work probably like maybe 3 hours of overtime a day and maybe one Saturday a month. And I'm still swimming and drowning, but that's okay because that's what we're here for right now.
Banks and loan servicers all over the place are having a hard time keeping up. Michael Barr is an assistant secretary at the Treasury Department who helped develop the Making Home Affordable program.
A number of firms are doing a good job ramping up the infrastructure they need to make this work, and a number of firms don't have that in place yet and have to do a much better job in the coming weeks.
Housing counselor Michelle McKeever says she's starting to see some results. A loan modification for one of her clients just went through after only a month of back and forth with the bank. The homeowner's payments have been slashed in half. So far, the Treasury Department says more than 270,000 loan modification offers have gone out. Treasury doesn't have data on how many have been accepted. But the Making Home Affordable program is supposed to help 3 to 4 million homeowners. Some of them are probably sitting on hold right now. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
We're back with more Getting Personal, and I'm here with our economics editor, Chris Farrell, once again. And Chris, how about we talk about credit for a little bit?
Okay.
You know, we've been covering all these new rules and regulations to credit cards, but of course they're not going to take effect for another several months. So lots of folks with questions, and one of them is Beth in the Bronx, New York. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
So what's your question for us?
Well, I'm wondering, it's been suggested to me that I use the money that I have in my mutual funds to pay off the credit card debt that I've acquired over the past year, with the rationale being that the interest on the money market account is less than what's accruing on the credit cards.
I can imagine it's a lot less.
Yeah, significantly. So, but the problem is that, you know, I don't want to do it. This is my only savings. It's something that I have thought that I'm never going to touch till I'm, you know, 80.
And how old are you now?
33.
All right. So, Chris, she's got a 50-year timeline here.
Okay.
What do you think about taking out this savings money to pay off the credit cards?
It's not a bad idea to take the money, pay off the credit card debt. You know, the mathematics of paying, what's the interest rate on your credit cards?
Oh, they're in the 20s, so they're pretty high.
And your savings is probably less than 1%?
Yeah, probably.
Okay. So, you know, the mathematics works. But there's a couple things that I would toss in there. The worst situation, let me just put that right out. The worst situation would be to take your savings, attack the credit card debt, and a year from now have credit card debt again.
Right.
And that's why I always had this slight hesitation before people do something like this is to go, okay, can you make a plan that over the next year or so, you can get rid of this credit card debt and you're not going to go back to it? In which case, leave the savings where it is. What was the calculation, Tess? Half century?
Yeah.
Time horizon? But, you know, you might need it in the next year or two at the same time. And there's a certain psychological safety of having some money that you can tap. But what I really want to do is, why are you in credit card debt? How long would it take you to get out of credit card debt? And then if you got out of credit card debt, would you stay out of credit card debt?
Yeah.
So what do you think, Beth? Is that something where you can hold yourself back from putting more money on the credit card as you pay it off?
Yeah, I'd like to. I think that, you know, times are pretty tough and uncertain. You know, I'm a freelance worker, so budgeting's tough.
Yeah.
It's all a balancing act. And the balancing act for you is to be very aggressive about paying off the credit card debt, not adding to it. And that's a way that it will make sense for you to sort of keep it aside in case times get tougher.
Oh, yeah. Yep, I can be aggressive.
Sounds great. Good luck. Let us know how it goes.
All right, thanks. I will.
And one more credit issue from Karis in Tallahassee, Florida. She wrote in to say that her credit card is upping the minimum payment from 2% to 5%. Unfortunately, though, she has a large balance. She has been paying more than the minimum each month. But her question is, can they really do this? And does she have any recourse? Oh, yes, they can do pretty much anything they want right now, especially because this legislation doesn't go into effect until next year.
What they're saying is this new legislation, this new law is forcing them to make these changes. I personally think what it is, it's a changing their business model so they can make more money. I think for the consumer, you're just going to have to continue to meet those payments. And again, you know, can I just sort of take a step back, Tess, and all these questions that we're getting about credit and credit cards, everybody who's calling is carrying a balance. And therefore, the changing of the terms hurts them. And this is why so many people are struggling to pay off their credit card debt, to get out of credit card debt, and then you want to stay out of credit card debt, because then it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if they say the minimum is now 5%. It doesn't matter if they say it's a variable rate.
So you can go ahead and use a credit card, but be sure to pay it off each month, and then none of this matters.
That's right. Oh, and Tess, could I add one more thing? Change the subject?
Okay.
I made a mistake.
Oh, no, you did not.
I did.
Oh, no. Well, let's deal with this.
I've slept for a long time over this one. Remember we were talking about checking your child's credit report?
Right. We had someone write in who literally had a newborn, and they were wondering if they should start checking the credit report because the newborn does have a Social Security number.
Well, I was right when I said that you can check whether or not there's been identity theft with the credit bureau with your child, but you can't do it online through one of the ways that you and I do, where we just go and we monitor our credit report, right? And we're just very routine. What you have to do, if you suspect that there has been some identity theft with your child or you're nervous about it, you have to go to each of the three credit reporting bureaus, TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian, and then you communicate with them in writing. Each of them has their procedures, and they lay it out for you, some in more detail, some in less detail. Nevertheless, you do it with each bureau. You do it in writing, and that's a way you can check. They all three say, look, don't do this unless you have a good reason. But if you suspect, we have procedures.
Excellent clarification. I hope you can get some sleep now.
I'm going to try.
Okay.
I'm going to try.
Well, that's all the time we've got for Getting Personal on this week's show. You can find answers to these and many, many more questions on our website. It's marketplace.org, where you will also find Chris's blog. Or you can give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Des.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We're all aware of the effects of layoffs on those employees who get pink slipped. Not so much about the folks who are left behind in the office. Of course, they are the lucky ones, but they're also dealing with low morale and heavy workloads. What's a boss to do? Well, you could hold a meeting, maybe send out some emails thanking everyone for pitching in, or you could suggest that on one Friday, everyone come to work naked. The employees of One Best Way, a design and marketing firm in the north of England, have done just that. And their managing director, Mike Owen, joins us now from the office in Newcastle. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So have you partaken in this Friday event?
Yeah, it was 3 or 4 weeks ago now. We worked with a business psychologist guy called David Taylor. He's an author of 3 books called The Naked Leader. And he reckoned that he could bond us so closely as a team that by the Friday, we would be comfortable enough with each other to work naked. So there you go. Don't giggle.
I'm sorry. I'm really going to try not to giggle too much
okay.
here. Were you yourself clothing less?
You've just gone straight to the killer question straight away, haven't you?
Really? Uh-huh.
It's the most important question of all. But yeah, I mean, I actually drove to work naked, yeah.
So if you drove to work naked, then that means you left your house naked and you walked from the car into the office naked as well?
That's correct. And it gets scarier, doesn't it? But that's the fact, yeah. It was early in the morning, so I didn't frighten anyone.
Okay.
Maybe a couple of squirrels, but that's it.
Well, you want to describe the experience for us?
Basically, it's based on the principle that lots of businesses set themselves goals, but most goals are really either too easy or things that you kind of understand. I think good businesses should set themselves goals which are really quite unusual. It makes you think differently. And, you know, we're a creative agency, One Best Way, and we're much braver than we were.
But really, what is the point of a goal of going naked for a Friday?
It didn't necessarily, I mean, it's a really good question because it needn't have been naked, really. I mean, the media, of course, have latched onto the nakedness, and it's been...
Well, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I mean, and you know that that's the reason, one of the reasons why we actually chose that as the goal. But the point is, if you're going to do something, you only live once, so do something interesting.
What do you think this has done for your staff, ultimately? I mean, you know, for all of us who work in a workplace, in an
yeah.
office,
yeah.
describe the benefits.
No problem. It's actually quite easy to do, and can I ask you a question? How long have you worked where you've worked?
8 years.
Okay. I mean, in your 8 years, you'll be very close to some people, but not as close as we are to each other here. it really does speed up the way we communicate with each other. It takes it to another level. There may be things that sometimes when you're talking to your colleagues or if they're talking to you, stuff gets in the way, you know? And we're much better now at clear thinking and clear communication.
I suppose maybe it's my American prudishness, but I would find it awfully distracting if all of my coworkers walked around naked.
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree. I mean, we did this for 2 or 3 hours, and you know, I'd read an email, and I would think, what have I just read? Because I couldn't concentrate. I just couldn't concentrate. So you're exactly right.
So this business psychologist comes in, and you decide maybe it's a good idea. Did people at first maybe think you were a bit nuts?
Yeah. To answer your question directly, it's a crazy idea. But I'm really one of these people who, without hurting anybody or anybody's feelings, you live once, so go for it.
All right. Well, I think my next step is to go around and ask my colleagues if they would like to partake in this kind of experiment, and we'll let you know how it goes.
Okay. Well, good luck with that.
Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bob Moon, senior business correspondent. You've been at Marketplace for a while. I assume you are in favor of staff getting to know one another.
Certainly.
What would you think of all of us perhaps coming in without clothes on Friday?
You want the bare facts, do you? Never take off your coat.
Phyllis Owens, commentary editor.
I think it takes TMI to a whole new level. Too much information? Maybe it's just me.
John Haas, editor at Marketplace.
I think the psychological damage would be irretrievable.
Betsy Streisand, senior editor.
I think I'd stay home. And I can't think what would be scarier, me having to be naked or me having to look at my coworkers naked.
Eve Tro, yes. Assistant producer here at Marketplace Money.
Two words. Seat covers.
And that is a fully clothed Marketplace Money for this week. Next time we hear from a Las Vegas mortgage broker who experienced both sides of the boom.
I kept thinking it was going to get better, it's going to get better, and it just got worse and worse and worse.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah, not even in a bathing suit, Clark, with Stephen, that is not my definition of team spirit, Hoffman, and Eve, seat cover, Tro. Our technical director is Josh, sure, why not, Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. York. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess, never, ever, ever gonna happen, Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com.
American Public Media.